Welcome to The Inner Circle, the podcast where the Radius Group, a team of experienced wealth advisors, brings you inside the circle of smart financial planning. With a network of industry experts, the Radius Group discusses the latest trends while sharing timeless wealth management techniques. So whether you're looking to optimize your portfolio, minimize taxes, or plan for your future, The Inner Circle is here to provide exclusive and valuable insights.
Welcome back to another episode of The Inner Circle. I'm Tiffany Kellner, Managing Director with The Radius Group.
And I'm Blair Cornell, Managing Director with The Radius Group.
Today, we are talking about what's driving markets, the forces shaping the economy, and what investors should be paying attention to moving forward.
That's right, Tiffany. There's no shortage of headlines right now. Every time you open your phone, there's something new competing for your attention, whether that's geopolitics, policy changes, inflation concerns, or market volatility. The challenge for investors is figuring out what's noise and what actually matters.
And that is exactly why we're excited to welcome today's guest. Joining us is Mike Ryan, Vice Chairman of UBS Global Wealth Management. Mike has spent more than four decades in the financial industry and is widely recognized as one of UBS's leading market experts.
Many of our listeners, especially longtime UBS clients, probably recognize Mike's name. Mike previously served as the Chief Investment Officer Americas for UBS Global Wealth Management and has helped shape investment perspectives across some of the most consequential market environments over the last several decades.
Yes, around UBS, Mike is a bit of a living legend.
That's right.
And we're very lucky to have him joining us today. Mike, welcome to the Inner Circle.
Tiffany, thank you. Blair, thank you. I'm not sure if you blush on podcast, but I'm blushing right now. Thank you for the introduction.
Mike, before we dive into the market outlook, maybe we can just spend a few minutes discussing the current health of the economy. You know, oil prices seem to have surged to fresh highs and inflation posted its biggest gains in nearly 3 years. How concerned should we be about the current macro backdrop?
I think that is the key question, because before you dive into anything on the markets or you start talking about how you position, you need to understand what the real economy is doing. And there's actually some good news here, Brian. I think what we're seeing so far is this expansion has proven to be remarkably durable and resilient. You know, the economy has weathered through some of the things you just talked about, whether it's inflation, concerns about Iran, high interest rates, concerns about tariffs. We've kind of weathered through them. So the good news is this expansion has proved and will prove to be remarkably durable. But we have to understand that there's going to be some headwinds along the way. And I think what we're contending with is the following. Number one, labor force growth, which has been one of the big catalysts driving personal income growth, that's helped households consume, that's kept engaged in the economy, that's beginning to slow. We're certainly seeing affordability issues start to strike those households as well, because at the same time you're starting to see labor force growth slow and you're starting to see wage and salary gains start to moderate, you're seeing big impact in terms of inflation is taking a bite or bigger bite out of consumer households, right? So that's going to be one of the things that tempers growth going forward and limits growth. I think the other dynamic here, as you already talked about, you know, it's the issue with the conflict in Iran. Look, the longer that we have energy prices elevated, the more it represents a consumption tax on households, and therefore it represents a headwind. So those are the things that I think are going to temper growth. Two of the reasons I think this expansion will continue through the balance this year into next year have to do with, one is policy, and that's fiscal policy. You know, we kind of forgot we passed this One Big Beautiful Bill Act that basically is allowing now more fiscal stimulus into the economy. We basically look at it as about a 1% incremental growth to the economy over the course of 2026. That's certainly helping as people get their rebate checks, as you're no longer seeing the taxation of either overtime or tips. That's helping. So that's going to be a big catalyst. But the last thing is probably the one that's the most obvious and the one most powerful, and that is this capital spending cycle that's associated with artificial intelligence. Let me give you a sense of this, Blair. So about 2 years ago, we had estimated that this year you would see as much as $350 billion in CapEx spending for AI. I mean, it's a pretty powerful driver of growth. Mm-hmm. We're actually on track right now to see about $750 billion of incremental spend in just AI-related CapEx. Mm. So that alone is enough to keep the economy going. So for all those reasons, there's certain things we have to be concerned about. Again, you talked about inflation, we talked about rates, we talked about Iran. But I do think that this expansion is going to prove durable for just those reasons.
That's incredible.
So let's build on that just a little, because whenever we're talking about broader economy, interest rates inevitably become a part of the conversation. So could you focus a bit on the Fed and how you think they'll likely react to the current conditions? Do you think they'll continue cutting rates or maybe begin raising them?
So, Tiffany, I always say that the hardest job in the world is being president of the United States. I think the second hardest job is being the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Because you think about it, you're expected to make these incredible decisions that affect both the real economy and financial markets, not just in the United States, but globally. You do it with access to imperfect and dated information, and you're expected by the politicians to get it all right. Right? That's an awful lot to ask of a Fed chair.
Right, right.
Now, what's complicating this right now is that there are a few things that are happening all at once that's making the Fed's job more difficult. Number one, we're dealing with one of the most stubborn and resilient inflation cycles we've seen since the global financial crisis. And this is one that's causing some challenges for Fed policymakers because you don't want to overreact to inflation, but you can't afford to ignore it. At the same time, we're seeing this powerful structural change, artificial intelligence, that has the potential to impact labor markets and inflation going forward. So those two things are happening at the same time that we're seeing a leadership transition at the Fed. Remember, we have a new Fed chairman. Mm-hmm. Kevin Warsh was confirmed. He's now taken office. So there's always a transition that makes it difficult for the Fed to come to consensus on decisions when you have a new leader, right? So all those things are happening at once. And by the way, against that backdrop, we probably have one of the most polarized or splits within the Fed that we've ever seen, where mm-hmm. you have one camp that's focused on concerns about inflation, the others that's focused on concerns about growth. So that's a pretty tough dynamic. What it basically translates into, Tiffany, is I think for the near term, both as Kevin Warsh goes through his transition, builds his leadership credentials, establishes a consensus, and as the Fed sorts through this near-term inflation challenge but longer-term AI pressures, I think the Fed is on the sidelines for now. Mm. Doesn't mean they're on the sidelines forever, but I do think that the chances are that the Fed doesn't raise rates, doesn't begin cutting rates, rather, probably until the end of the year at the earliest, and it's going to be very data dependent. So near term, Fed's on the sidelines. I think by the end of the year, we'll see enough evidence that both growth is slowing and inflation pressures are rolling over that gives the Fed the latitude to begin cutting rates. The last part of this, though, is concerns or fears that the Fed's going to raise rates. I really don't see it. You know, as labor markets soften, as inflation begins to roll over in the second half of the year, that's going to create a better dynamic where the Fed can remain on the sidelines and ease rather than raise rates.
That's great, Mike. That's really helpful. And let's come back to, you just talked a few minutes ago and kind of hinted on the Iran war. Let's go back to that. There's an old saying that wars are easy to start but hard to stop. And this one appears to be holding true to that form. And this conflict, we're now in, I think, third or fourth month, and much longer than maybe the 4 to 6 weeks that we originally had expected. Could you share how you're assessing the current situation in the Middle East and kind of how you see that, the most likely scenario of how this might affect the global economy?
So let me start with an observation that geopolitics are hard to forecast. Wars are impossible to predict. You know, the notion about what the outcome will be and how they end. I do think, despite that, though, we have to have base cases and scenarios about what we see happening. So here's what we're looking for in Iran. We still believe that the most likely scenario is that there's some kind of a deal reached, some kind of a negotiated settlement. I won't go so far as to call it a peace agreement, but let's just say some negotiated settlement that allows the process of de-escalation and step down from the current tensions in the Middle East. Now, that's important because that's going to be a critical step in the reopening of the Straits of Hormuz. It allows oil to begin to flow. It allows oil prices to begin to normalize, right? So that's our base case. Now, the concern, of course, is that we do know that when you're in these high-stakes negotiations, when there's an awful lot going on and certainly distractions from both the Iranian side and the U.S. side, there's a risk now that rather than de-escalate, there's a misinterpretation or a misunderstanding and things actually get beyond control and we see an escalation again. And therefore, there's a risk, of course, the non-base case or the risk case is that this conflict escalates again. And what that would lead to then would be a significant impact in the energy markets. Not only would you see energy coming out of and being transported through the Straits of Hormuz would basically come to a standstill, but what you have also the risk is that production facilities throughout the Gulf region are targeted in this proliferation of the conflict. It's what we call horizontal escalation, where Iran decides to make it more difficult for the U.S. and its allies by targeting energy production, the reason to kind of raise the pain point for U.S. allies to kind of push the U.S. toward the negotiating table. So if that were to happen, what you'd see is this conflict would last a lot longer. The implications for energy markets would be much stronger. And the impact on financial markets and the real economy would be much more significant. Again, that's not our base case, but it's something you simply can't ignore because, as you said, you know, they're easy to start, they're hard to stop. And how and when this conflict comes to a conclusion is really important for the real economy and financial markets.
Yeah, that's great. Okay.
Want to switch gears just for a minute then, Mike, with Iran dominating the headlines and issues, the issues of tariffs and trade disputes have pretty much faded from the headlines and more became, you know, back burner information. Yet these remain a lingering issue for both the real economy and financial markets. Can you briefly give us an update on where we stand with current tariffs and the impacts you see in those going forward?
So this is another one of those good news, bad news moments, Tiffany. So let me start on the good news. So the good news from a tariff perspective, you may have a different political view on this, but on the tariff perspective, remember that Liberation Day imposed these what I would consider to be far-reaching and significant sanctions. And the president used what he perceived as the authority under the IEEPA. That's the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, where he imposed these broad-based tariffs that affected most industries in most countries around the world. The Supreme Court struck those down, said, okay, they're not constitutional. You can't use that authority, that it's an overreach in terms of the reading of the act itself. Now, the administration immediately pivoted then and said, okay, let's use secondary tariff options. So it's what they call the 122 section, it's a 232, it's a 301. So these are different clauses of different trade acts that now allow the administration to put tariffs in place. Now, the good news here is that while those tariffs are being put in place, they're not as severe or as broad as the original tariffs. And they basically mean that the effective tariffs are somewhere between 10 and 12%, much lower. Remember, at one point when the IEEPA was first threatened there, we could potentially have seen tariffs as high as 27%, right? Mm. So this is significantly lower. So the good news is we're getting some tariff relief, but there's still some uncertainty in terms of the duration of those tariffs, whether they could be added to or whether the potential that the administration even raises those. So I do think while it's not an acute issue, it's not the biggest issue, tariffs will remain a source of uncertainty both for business decision makers as well as investors because we just don't know exactly how it plays out and we don't know exactly what the end game will be in terms of the tariff policy.
Hmm. That's interesting. There are a lot of unknowns there, that's for sure. So another big unknown, we probably couldn't have a market discussion like this in 2026 without spending at least a few minutes talking about artificial intelligence. Maybe, Mike, you could share with us how you and your team are currently processing this phenomenon and kind of what you think the impact will be kind of largely, and is this being overhyped by the promoters or do you think it's for real?
So I do think, to begin with, I think it's both overhyped and underappreciated. Because I think in the short term, we get focused and we get really excited and we get caught up in a few of the companies, right? But I think when you have to step back a bit, Blair, and look at this technology, what it represents, this is going to be one of the most powerful, transformative, and disruptive technologies that we've ever seen, certainly in our generation. Mm-hmm. But I would argue this is perhaps the most disruptive technology the world has ever seen. In fact, I was asked by someone if I thought that this was going to be as big as the internet. I said, now you have to go back further than that. You have to go back to the creation of the Gutenberg printing press to find something that was as powerful and transformational as artificial intelligence. Now, again, we're still early days on this. We're still at the what I call the infrastructure or the nascent stage of this, where we're starting to see the brick and mortar being laid, the tools being developed, and we don't know exactly where this is going to go. Anybody who tells you that they have this roadmap for how AI will play out and the implications it will have for the real economy, they're either deluding themselves or they're naive, because this will develop in ways we can't possibly anticipate. So again, I'll go back to what I think AI and how we need to think about this. Number one is we have to focus on, okay, how will technology be developed? Who will be the initial winners in terms of providing those picks and shovels or the infrastructure? And that's where a lot of the monetization or the value has been created. It's been literally in the chips, in the servers, in the data centers, in the model building, right? And that's where a lot of the focus has been. But I do think the bigger payoff and where we'll start to see more focus going down is when we move from that infrastructure phase to the application phase. And what I mean by the application phase is when we start to see the technology being deployed, not just within the technology sector, when it gets deployed across the entire economy. It means in the financial sector. It means in utilities, industrial companies, consumer service companies, as healthcare companies. As we begin to embed this technology in our everyday use case for businesses, the impact on this will be profound. And I think there's two phases of that as well, Blair. I think there's the first phase, which is what I'll call the productivity phase. And this is where I use AI to basically improve efficiency, raise productivity, and cut costs. Mm-hmm. And by the way, a lot of people are dismissive. They said, oh, productivity, how much does that matter? Remember, from a corporate standpoint, if I can deploy some technology or some new tool that can reduce costs, every dollar I take out in cost goes right to the bottom line in earnings. So this can be a real powerful driver of corporate profitability just using it as a productivity tool. I think the bigger, longer-term play here, though, and where the real benefits from AI will come, is what I call the creativity phase. It's in the creation of new goods and services, new products that will be developed over time that people will come to use, that there'll be new revenue sources associated with that. Now, by the way, when people ask me, what will it be? And my answer is, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Because the technology is still evolving, the use cases are still developing, and what we perceive as our needs are going to change as this technology evolves. And the example I use all the time is the cell phone, is the our mobile phones, right? Now, we can't survive without them. I mean, my children are crippled if their phone coverage is blocked out for 20 minutes, right? But think about that. When that first developed, it was sort of a cool to have thing, but you really didn't need it. Right now, it's become an essential. So what happens is when this technology launches, and when this technology becomes embedded, it doesn't just create products, it creates needs. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think this creativity phase is going to be such a powerful driver. So early days, I'm sure there's some overhyping of some companies and probably some return on capital that we'll never see because the investment probably wasn't prudently made. But over the long term, this is going to be one of the most transformative, powerful technologies the world's ever seen. And it will create enormous opportunities as companies begin to integrate it and monetize it in their business.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And exciting to see it happen.
Yeah,
it is exciting. I mean, look, Tiffany, you think about this. I mean, we only get these incredibly, transformational pivots in technology. They only happen, maybe once or twice in a generation, and we're living through one. And I'd argue, again, this one may have no parallel in history when we think about the ultimate way it's going to really be applied.
So you've helped us connect a lot of dots here, but let me see if I have all of this straight. We're in the midst of a Middle East conflict that shows few signs of abating anytime soon, with tensions continuing to escalate over the Strait of Hormuz. There's lingering uncertainty over current status of tariff regime and what may or may not come next in the trade front. In April alone, we lost 40,000 jobs to the tech sector. The annual inflation rate rose to 3.8% in April, which is the highest in nearly 3 years. Against these incredibly unsettled backdrop, you're still thinking and looking for a 2.2% real GDP growth rate, possible interest rate cuts, 11% in earnings growth with about 7,500 price target for the S&P by the end of the year. So how do you reconcile all of this?
So Tiffany, it's even harder to reconcile because since we've had our conversation, we've actually raised our earnings estimate to 20% and our target for the S&P 500 to 79. So it's even more.
Say we're already there.
So how do I reconcile this? So when you look at these things, any economic cycle and any market cycle is filled with a host of challenges, right? There's always some headwinds you have to contend with. However, what typically drives equity markets is not the distractions. It's not these one-offs that, pose challenges. It ultimately comes down to the resilience of the economy and the power dynamics of corporate earnings. And this is what we are seeing. I mentioned before that this economy is proving to be remarkably resilient. By the way, right now, Tiffany, the GDP Now tracker, which basically measures economic activity at this point in the quarter, it's showing the real economy growing at 4.5%. So despite all those things you just mentioned, despite all those challenges, despite all those headwinds, the economy is managing through that. Businesses are figuring out a way to not only survive but thrive through those challenges and those headwinds. Now, at the same time, those same companies that are kind of adapting to that environment, They're also figuring out ways to draw that to the bottom line. So this is proving to be one of the strongest earnings cycles that we've seen in a number of years. In the last quarter, earnings were up about 27%. Even when I take out extraordinary factors that are associated with the run-up in these AI companies that are embedded in some of the earnings of these public companies, even when I strip that out, it's still about 19%. So what we're in the midst of is a really, really strong earnings cycle. At the end of the day, that's what drives equity markets higher. So as much as we can talk about the concerns or the issues that are distractions, and even some of these things that will prove to be some challenges and will add, by the way, Tiffany, to volatility. Those things we just talked about, I don't think they're enough to disrupt either the economic expansion or the duration of this bull market, but they will lead to periodic bouts of volatility. There will be times that we'll start focusing on, okay, will the Fed perhaps have to pivot and raise rates? We will be concerned about, okay, will this Iranian conflict, you know, break containment and could see $150 or $200 a barrel on oil? You know, will inflation remain stickier than the Fed would like? For all those reasons, we'll probably get these bouts of volatility, which means the market doesn't go up in a straight line. But at the end of the day, I do think strong enough economy, moderating inflation, really solid earnings growth translates into solid returns for the S&P 500 for the balance of the year. Mm,
that's great.
All right, Mike, my final question. It's a two-pronged question. You have 30 seconds to answer. What excites you the most and what concerns you most about the current environment? And since I'm an optimist, let's start with the negative first and we'll end on a high note.
So my answer to the question is going to be the same for both of them. I hate to sound like I'm just pounding on this, but it's AI. What concerns me the most is AI. You know, we're talking about a technology I just mentioned to you is truly transformative. It's innovative, but it's also going to be incredibly disruptive. It is going to alter the way we live our lives. It's going to change social dynamics. It could lead to greater geopolitical tension, more social unrest, right? And by the way, we don't have a really good framework to control this technology because we don't understand it yet. I mean, yeah, there is some in the science community who have a handle on the developments that are occurring right now, but the things that will happen over the next 6, 12, 18, 24 months, people are only guessing at, right? This technology will evolve very quickly. So to me, I'd say the biggest risk or concern I see relates to the misuse or the malevolent use, I should say, of AI, because this is a technology that's so powerful. And if we don't have an understanding of it and we don't properly regulate and control it, this could undermine, again, not just the real economy, but also social cohesion. Now, let me flip the script about the thing I'm most excited about. It's AI. Mm-hmm. Because I said before, this can completely transform the way we see lives. And by the way, it will impact the way we develop drugs. It will impact the way we extract minerals. It will impact the way corporations do businesses. It will allow us to connect from a human scale in ways we've never done before. It will change the nature of work. It will create incredible wealth. It'll create new industries. It will create new products, new services. As I said before, new needs that we didn't know we needed, right? So this technology is so incredibly exciting. And again, I have very few parallels throughout history that I can compare this to, other than, as I said before, moments like, you know, the Gutenberg printing press, that you think about how that technology didn't just change the world then, it transformed the world we live in today. Mm-hmm. Without the Gutenberg printing press, we would not have the retention of information that we have today that we benefit from. And by the way, that retention of information has been a powerful driver for human development. So I think AI will be that impactful in terms of the way it impacts our world.
That's great. This has been such a fantastic conversation, Mike. I really appreciate it. We've certainly covered a lot today, whether that's from inflation, Fed policy, to geopolitics, certainly artificial intelligence, and what it all means for investors to try to navigate a really dynamic environment.
You know, and one thing we always try to remind clients is that while headlines can change so quickly, having a thoughtful plan and staying focused on long-term goals matter more than reacting emotionally to any short-term noise.
Mike, thank you again for joining us and sharing your perspective and feedback on everything we asked you today.
Yeah.
So first of all, Tiffany, Blair, thank you so much for having me. And by the way, one thing we didn't talk about that's critically important is that, you know, in this world we live in, we talked about the complexities of it. We talked about the challenges. We talked about the opportunities. But putting those in proper context requires a thoughtful discussion and an engagement with investment professionals. And I think this is where you guys are so important in this process because, you know, we can get all this information, But how do you take it from information and create insight? Mm. And what we really need to do and what we do in our business is translating information into insight. So I'm really thankful for the job that you do and the work you do on behalf of your clients.
Well said. Well, thank you.
I appreciate that. Yeah. And thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and share The Inner Circle with someone who might benefit from this conversation.
Until next time, everyone, take care and thanks for being part of The Inner Circle.
Today's episode features financial advisors with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 3601 Rigby Road, Miamisburg, Ohio, and can be reached at radiusgroup@ubs.com. This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary.